It appears that both attorneys are ready, so I will call the second case on today's calendar. The second case is number A24-0986, State of Minnesota versus Javier Diaz Garcia. Counsel, both attorneys I know are familiar with our standard procedures, which are essentially the same on the video format as in the courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may begin by identifying yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of Appellant Javier Garza. Mr. Garza made a timely request for substitute counsel, which was based on his attorney's failure to communicate or show him discovery. The district court violated his right to due process of law when it failed to conduct any inquiry into his request and misadvised him that it had no authority or under any circumstances to appoint a substitute public defender. The only appropriate remedy under these circumstances is to remand this case for a hearing on Mr. Garza's request so the district court can conduct the necessary inquiry and determine whether exceptional circumstances existed warranting the appointment of substitute counsel.
Counsel, can I start with a question about remedy? As I read the case law, even if a judge errs by misstating the ability to appoint substitute counsel or errs by failing to make an inquiry, we review those errors under the harmless error standard. And under the harmless error standard, we would need to be convinced that the defendant was prejudiced as a result of the failure to explore substitute counsel. How was your client harmed? I note that the case was tried. You're not pointing to anything in the trial record that says, well, had he had a different attorney, here's what would have been done differently. Or maybe the proper inquiry is, what was the performance deficit at trial? Because this whole area of law focuses on competencies. And I hear what you're saying about, well, the lawyer showed up for three omnibus hearings and said he wasn't ready, needed more time. But at the end of the day, the omnibus hearings, didn't result in the conviction. The trial resulted in the conviction. How was the attorney not competent or proficient at trial?
So, Your Honor, we don't need to reach that analysis at this point. The
Why
only
don't we? Because you only get re relief if you can show error and prejudice.
error needs to be determined before we can look into whether or not there was prejudice. The error here is the
Okay,
denial
let's assume
of his.
for the sake of argument, there was error. Okay, I'll give you
Okay.
that. What's the harm?
The harm is he was denied his right to have a hearing to inquire into his request for a substitute counsel. Our request
But
for
that's
remedy.
the harm would. It seems to me has to be that as a result of that, he had a lawyer whose competencies were not adequate. So how did the lawyer fail to perform at trial?
Well, before we can get to that step in the analysis, we have to determine whether there was error in refusing to discharge
Okay,
counsel.
I just told you, assume I agree with you, there was error. What is the harm? How was your client harmed? In the context of he had a trial before a jury, he was convicted. What about that trial do you point to say, see, here's the harm. The lawyer that you wouldn't consider replacing represented my client at trial, and here's why the lawyer's representation shows he was not competent or proficient, such that engaging in this process to get a new lawyer would have made a difference.
So I think you already know my position is that we don't get to that step yet in the analysis. But if we do, the errors here that occurred after the court denied the request for substitute counsel were that counsels continued to request continuances, told the district court that he wasn't prepared, and then conceded that there were no issues with probable cause and asked the court, submitted to the court that there was probable cause for the charges.
Okay, wasn't this a recorded control buy?
Correct.
How did that not meet the probable cause standard? What is the probable cause standard for charging counsel?
So he could be the probable cause standard is a reasonable likelihood of securing a conviction. But if he would be able to,
I'm sure that's the standard.
he would have been able to challenge probable cause
Okay, but
based on
why do you
issues that
think he
happened
would have,
during this. I'm
why
sorry.
would he have won a probable cause challenge?
We don't have to prove that he would have won a probable cause challenge. That's not the analysis here. The analysis goes all the way back to his initial request and the court's misadvising him. We don't know if he would have been able to pursue this request if the court didn't misadvise him. The only cases that we have regarding this specific issue on misadvice are State v. Lamar and then the unpublished State v. Walford that I provided to this court, I believe yesterday or the day before, as supplemental authority. In State v. Lamar, the court found it was not an error to misadvise him about his right to substitute counsel because in Lamar, the defendant did not even make an explicit request, nor did he support it with any reasoning. So in
Okay.
that case, they said there was no request.
In Lamar, the court said, while the trial court told Lamar he could not have a different public defender under any circumstance, this is not an accurate statement of the law. So we have error. Here, there was no explicit request for a change in counsel and no showing of improper representation. Any error, therefore, was harmless, citing McGee, which says a defendant is not entitled to a new trial if the trial court's failure to ascertain whether good cause exists for substitution of appointed counsel causes no harm. So I guess I'm just coming at it this way. We have this error, and we had a trial, and he was convicted, and you're not pointing to anything that happened at that trial to indicate he did not receive adequate, competent representation from counsel at trial. So I'm just questioning how you can show that the error wasn't harmless.
Because we don't get to the harmless error part of the analysis until we can determine whether there was an error in refusing to appoint him counsel and what that error was. The error we're dealing with in refusing to appoint him counsel is a denial of his due process rights.
Okay,
The court.
but if there was error in refusing to appoint him counsel, and he should have had a different attorney at trial. But he went to trial, and his attorney's representation was there's nothing we can point to that says, yeah, this guy was not competent. He was not proficient. This man got convicted as a result of not having a different attorney. I don't see how we can grant you relief or your client relief.
We didn't get to that point. He wasn't given a new attorney. He wasn't given the opportunity to say this counsel was deficient and then was granted a new attorney. He wasn't able to present any reasons after his initial request because the court shut down his ability
Why
to
does
ask for a
that
new attorney.
matter if, in the end, his attorney did an adequate job at trial? That's the essence of a harmless error analysis. Yes, there was error. Yes, he didn't get to do any of those things. But in the end, did it matter? Did it not matter because the attorney he was stuck with did a fine job at trial?
I don't concede his attorney did a fine job at trial. I think there
What did his
were.
attorney do wrong? You haven't identified anything that the attorney did that suggests he was not competent to represent your client at trial. And I mean, to be clear, I don't view competency. If a lawyer says, look, I'm not ready to go forward with the omnibus, let's continue it, that doesn't mean the lawyer's not competent. That just means a busy lawyer is asking for more time. The best evidence of performance is how'd the lawyer do at trial. I mean, we've got some unpublished cases, one of which I wrote, where that's, what we looked at, okay? The lawyer made appropriate challenges at voir dire. The lawyer made appropriate objections. The lawyer made appropriate suppression motions. The lawyer made sound legal arguments. The lawyer made persuasive closing arguments. I mean, that's what we look at to determine whether or not, in the end, the defendant was really harmed by the fact that he wasn't allowed full opportunity to explore substitute court-appointed counsel. So that's what I'm focusing on.
That is
I understand
only
if your position is, well, I shouldn't be doing that, then we'll leave it at that.
that
I just want
analysis.
you to know that that's how I'm going to analyze the case. So it would be helpful if you addressed it.
So that analysis is only appropriate if he was not initially misadvised. This is an abuse of discretion standard, and the abuse of discretion occurred when the district court based its decision on an erroneous view of the law. So the court, it's not even the court's decision whether or not to grant his request. that we're challenging here. It's before that decision occurred when the court gave him inaccurate legal advice that ceased him from even seeking out substitute counsel. The court told him, under no circumstances do I have any ability to appoint you a new attorney. And then you must either represent yourself or hire a private attorney. Appellant
Except
admitted he could do neither.
Miss Lockwood, Judge Riley here. As I read the record, May 22, he claimed that his counsel didn't provide him with discovery. And then you fast forward to July 23rd, he requested substitution of counsel, didn't say why, didn't raise serious allegations of inadequate representation. But and then after making that request, the district court said that it would, quote, let Garza bring that up at future hearings, end quote. But he never raised it again. So the judge left the door open and your client didn't say anything.
The door that was left open was if you want to represent yourself or hire a private attorney. Specifically, the first time that he made his concerns about his attorney, the court did not address them, but did continue the omnibus hearing. The second time he requested the made official request, his attorney came and said, I believe he wants to discharge me. He said, yes, I do. And then he had a back and forth exchange with the court, where the court informed him, you can't do that. Under Minnesota law, you are not entitled to discharge and pick and choose from the public defender's office. Do you understand that? He says, yes. Then the court further goes, so if I do, if you request to be discharging them from representing you, you have to hire a private attorney or represent yourself. He said, I do. Do you understand that? Is it still your desire to discharge them? I only want to discharge this public defender, is what he said. I don't care who else represents me, another public defender. The court three times repeats this erroneous legal advice. Again, says, I don't have any authority to appoint a different public defender. And again, the court says, so if I grant what you're asking me to do you understand you'll either need to hire a private attorney or represent yourself in this matter? He says, yes. Okay, now do you want some additional time to think about this before you make a decision? He said, I want to think about this. After receiving the court's erroneous advice that there was no way, under any circumstances, he could get a different court-appointed attorney, and acknowledging, telling the court he could not afford a private attorney and did not have the ability to represent himself, yes, he ceased to make that request again because the court told him that request would be fruitless. He said, the court said, I'm not going to bring it up again. We'll leave the issue alone. That's not what happened in other cases where the request was denied. Where the request was denied, courts actually did conduct the inquiry. Courts came in and made sure that they were still able to work together.
Ms.
That's
Lockwood,
not what happened in this case.
your brief cites Clark for the proposition that a district court must make a searching inquiry, quote unquote, if the defendant raises serious allegations of inadequate representation. To establish that premise, that the serious allegations, can you establish, can you show that he made serious allegations? But if we look solely at the transcript of the hearing in July of 2023, or do you need to rely upon the transcript of the hearing from May, more than a year earlier, from May of 2022, in order to establish that predicate?
Yes, it's important to review the record as a whole because those are circumstances leading up to and surrounding his request. The circumstances of his attorney asking for multiple continuances on the basis they have not been communicating is in line with client's concern that his attorney's not communicating with him or showing him discovery.
But
When
isn't
he
that,
made the, go ahead.
I mean, isn't that, I mean, the reality is that, I mean, how likely is it that a judge, if it's the same judge, is going to remember a hearing 15 months earlier, 14 months earlier, and what the reasons were stated at that hearing? I mean, it's easy for us on appeal to read the two transcripts, close together. The way they're presented to us, but in reality, when this happens in the district court, how do we know that the judge, if it was the same judge in July of 2023, even remembered what had been said at that May 2022 hearing?
We don't know. That's part of the problem. But
Okay,
the
so then
reason.
so then well, okay. And that goes back to my question. I mean, is it really fair to look at both transcripts, or should we confine ourselves to the second transcript from July of 2023 and then use that transcript alone to answer the question, did he make serious allegations of inappropriate representation?
No, you need to look at the entirety of the record. As the reviewing court, you need to know what was present in the case, especially considering the fact that we have this affirmative misadvice. He at this at we could be just looking at the July hearing if the district court had asked why. There was no question for why you want to do this. Instead, immediately the court gave him incorrect legal advice, which shut down his request. The court's incorrect legal advice that I cannot give you a new public defender under any circumstances was given to Mr. Garza before he had the opportunity to support his request. And that's part of my argument, is he could have provided additional support, but he was shut down by the court's erroneous legal advice. And that there is an abuse of discretion. The court believed it didn't have any authority to grant his request. We're looking at what the court thought and believed at the time, and that's what they believed and thought at the time. That's an error of law.
I understand that, and I think there's two parts to your argument. You're kind
Yes.
of you're alleging two different kinds of errors: the lack of a searching inquiry, also the misstatement of law. But I think both of those exist in Lamar as well, right? Excuse me. I mean, there was an allegation, but the Lamar court said, I think that the defendant did not make a serious allegation that required a searching inquiry.
It was not in Lamar, there was no specific request made. So he complained about an error of his attorney and asked, what would happen if I,
Let's,
asked.
well, I mean,
So he never made the official request. That was what
what's
the court ruled.
different between this case and Lamar if we confine ourselves to the July 2023 hearing?
What's different between this case and Lamar is in this case, there was an explicit request. The
At the
holding in
July,
Lamar
okay,
and in the July hearing, yes.
okay. I mean, it seems like you are. Can you summarize again what the request, or excuse me, what the complaint was, the serious allegation of inadequate representation at the second hearing?
In our case,
Yeah.
he wasn't given the opportunity to expand upon his allegations at the second hearing. It was his attorney that told the court he want his attorney began the hearing by saying he wants to discharge me. And then the court steps in and tells him, okay, you're entitled to one public defender, but you can't pick and choose. And do you understand that? Yes. Do you understand if I grant this request, you have to hire a private attorney to go pro se? He was not given any opportunity to explain his request. He was immediately told, this is not a request you can make, and then needed time to think about it. If he had come back and thought, well, maybe I can represent myself or found the money to go pro se after found the money to hire private counsel, excuse me, then he could have renewed that request. But he clearly didn't have the ability, as he said, to hire a private attorney or represent himself. So he didn't renew the request and he didn't provide further basis for the request because he had been told that would be fruitless endeavor. No matter what the reason is, you will not get a new public defender. And that's
Okay.
why looking at all the circumstances surrounding his request includes looking back at was there any issue with his public defender? Yes, at these previous hearings, he did raise a very specific issue. And leading up to his trial, that issue was still present. His attorney acknowledged his inability to communicate with him. And I think that the remedy that was awarded in the Walford unpublished case.
Now you're moving on, and we're past your initial
Oh, I
allotment of
apologize.
time.
You see, my
That's
time
okay.
is run.
I was waiting for you to finish answering my question, but I think, but we will make sure that we have time to hear your argument about Walford in your rebuttal time. But I think now we'll hear from Respondent's counsel. Counsel for respondent, please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent Respondent State of Minnesota in this appeal. Appellant claims the district court abused its discretion when it denied his request for a different public defender and asked this court to remand this case for the district court to conduct an evidentiary hearing to determine whether appellant's dissatisfaction with his public defender rose to the level of extraordinary circumstances that would require the district court to appoint a substitute attorney. But there is no need for a remand here for two reasons. First, because appellant made only vague allegations and did not voice serious allegations of inadequate representation when he requested the appointment of substitute counsel. Second, because even if the district court abused its discretion, and I concede that the district court's view of the law was erroneous, but it did not abuse its discretion by failing to conduct a searching inquiry, again, because that request was not coupled at the time it was made with serious allegations of inadequate representation. Second, even if the district court abused its discretion by failing to conduct the searching inquiry, as the court's questions have illuminated, that error was harmless. Appellant's counsel would ask this court to seemingly treat the mistaken view of the law as some sort of quasi-structural error that, when it occurs by itself, entitles somebody to relief without a required showing of prejudice. But that's simply not the case. That's not what Lamar held. Lamar had the same erroneous view of the law in this area by the district court. And this court conducted a harmless error analysis by looking at what effect the assumed error in not appointing substitute counsel had on the trial, and determining that that was harmless because there was no allegation of improper representation at trial. We've heard some speculation now for the first time from appellant's counsel at oral argument about what maybe there was as far as improper representation. First of all, any of those arguments were waived. They weren't made in the appellant's principal brief and they weren't made in the reply brief, despite the fact that I specifically argued in my brief that appellant had failed to show that the error was not harmless. There was no argument about harmless error. In fact, in the principal brief, appellant argues simply that we can't know whether there was any harm from the error because we didn't have a hearing. But that's arguing that the error by itself entitles you to some sort of relief without a showing of prejudice. And that's not how we conduct appellate review, absent a conclusion that this is structural error. And this court's binding precedent from Lamar holds that this isn't structural error, that this is error that's subject to the harmless error analysis. Appellant has failed to make a meaningful argument on that, didn't make any argument in the reply brief about how the error resulted in an unfair trial, there was improper representation, none of those arguments. If this court were to adopt appellant's proposed rule, essentially that any time the district court is mistaken about the law and you don't get a hearing, you on your request, even though it's not adequately supported by the appropriate allegations, you get a remand for an evidentiary hearing, that encourages piecemeal appellate litigation, and we'll be here on Garza 2, maybe Garza 3. There are multiple avenues that could have been explored by appellant for having building a record. She could have sought a appellant himself could have sought a stay and a remand for to file a petition for post-conviction relief to develop a record. None of that was done here. The appellant could have made alternative arguments. Even if I don't get a remand, here's how the error prejudiced me: raised allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel, pursued ineffective assistance of counsel claims on post-conviction relief. None of that's done here. And if we have a remand here for an evidentiary hearing when the alleged error hasn't been shown to cause harm, we can just keep doing this over and over again. Will we then, on the next time we come back up after the district court has a remand hearing, are we going to stay and then pursue post-conviction relief at that time? Is the district court going to be asked to consider whether the error in not appointing substitute counsel was harmless? At some point in time, there has to be a consideration of whether that error is harmless. And the appropriate time is now when the claim is brought. It's not later after there's been an evidentiary hearing or some other opportunity to develop the record. Those arguments could have been made in the alternative now, and they weren't. The appropriate way to do this is the way we always do appellate review. Not only does the appellant have to identify error, they have to identify how they were prejudiced by that error. And here, the appellant is asking this court to treat the error and the prejudice as the same thing. And that's simply not the case outside the context of structural error. I would like to address two specific points from the reply brief, and that came up to a certain extent in oral argument here today. First of all, there's this repeated claim that the appellant made a specific request for a different attorney and supported it with specific concerns about his attorney's failure to communicate with him and show discovery. I want the court to be absolutely clear. The first time his specific request for a different attorney was coupled with the specific concerns about his attorney's failure to communicate with him and show him discovery was in appellant's brief on appeal. He never coupled those two things together. And in that regard, this is like State v. Logan. In fact, State v. Logan, the non-precedential decision of this court that I cited in my brief, the appellant there repeatedly coupled his request for different counsel with specific concerns that still weren't sufficient to warrant appointment of substitute counsel. Here, appellant never coupled those concerns together. He brought his request to the district court on July 10th. He was given additional time to think about it and didn't bring it back up. He could have consulted with his public defender between the July 10th and the July 17th hearing and asked if, you know, what he needed to show, or asked, is the district court right about these things? There's no evidence that he did that. He had the opportunity to bring those things forward and readdress the issue with the district court. He didn't take it. And he didn't point back to the May 22 hearing. And I think it's completely unreasonable to expect the district court, operating without the benefit of a transcript, to remember from 15 months ago at a very brief hearing, allegations of frustrations that weren't even coupled with a request for substitute counsel at the time. Simply put, there is no support in the record that the appellant supported his request with specific concerns. This is simply not supported by the record. The second thing is, appellant's attorney did not concede that there was probable cause for the charges. Rather, he challenged it. It wasn't a particularly vigorous challenge, certainly, but as Judge Larkin pointed out in her question, it's a probable cause standard with a recorded controlled by. If you look at the transcript of the July 17th, 2023 continued omnibus hearing at page 3, appellant's counsel asked the court to consider probable cause for the charges. And then the district court specifically indicated it would review the issue of probable cause and put together a written order in that regard. And then the district court.
Could you remind the court what the probable cause standard is for that hearing?
The probable cause standard is whether the facts in the record, including reliable hearsay, provide essentially a question of fact on each of the elements of the charged offense. An honest and prudent person would hold a reasonable and strong suspicion that the defendant had committed the crime. That's the standard. That's all that the state had to establish in order to provide probable cause. This kind of on the record probable cause challenge is a standard approach to probable cause issues in cases that aren't really raise a substantial doubt about probable cause. I mean, this isn't a close case when it comes to the issue of probable cause. It's simply not. And
counsel, doesn't our case law provide that once there's, you know, even if there was probable cause challenge denied, trial, conviction, we then won't review the probable cause determination because that's such a low standard, and we now have a conviction which has to be based on proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So the conviction and the trial is where we look.
That's correct, Your Honor. The probable cause, after a defendant's been convicted at trial, probable cause challenges are irrelevant on appeal unless you essentially have the merger of some legal doctrine and an interpretation of the statute, sufficiency of the evidence question. So once the jury finds that the charges have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, this court doesn't review alleged defects in a probable cause challenge or a probable cause ruling. Simply put, appellant hasn't demonstrated that he was prejudiced by the error, as this court has reviewed prejudice in Lamar, which is binding precedent. Essentially, appellant is asking this court to overrule Lamar. I don't know how to put any finer point on it. And appellant hasn't identified any compelling circumstances to justify doing that. The only distinction appellant has drawn between this case and Lamar is that Lamar didn't make a specific request. Well, this court made this appellant did make a specific request. I acknowledge that, but the but what he didn't do is couple that specific request with serious allegations of inappropriate representation. So, well, this might have a specific request. It doesn't have the other element that's required to trigger the district court's responsibility to conduct a searching inquiry, particularly not at the July 10th, 2023 hearing, and asking the court to keep in mind a hearing from 15 months ago where the appellant expressed passing frustrations with his counsel, but didn't make a request for substitute counsel is simply unreasonable. It's easy for us all to look back at all the transcripts and hold them next to each other and say, well, why didn't the district court connect the dots? Well, it was the appellant's obligation to connect the dots for the district court, both at the district court and on appeal. And he didn't connect the dots at all. He had opportunities to connect the dots between his concerns about lack of communication and failure to show discovery 15 months ago and his request for substitute counsel. He never connected those dots.
So, Mr. Smith, I just want to make sure I understand the chronology. My understanding is that the first appearance, Mr. Garza was in the Renville jail. This is a Redwood County case. He appeared via Zoom, complained about lack of communication and preparedness, and asked that any future hearings be in person, which is what I think happened in the subsequent hearings. Am I right? And Ms. Lockwood can correct you if you're wrong.
I believe you're correct, Judge Riley. That is the chronology. And he was in Renville County. It could be he was in custody in Renville County, but Redwood County also contracts with Renville County to house some of his prisoners because of space reasons.
Okay.
So I don't know in this particular case which it was, but yes, he was in custody in Renville County in May of 2022. The court then accommodated the request for in-person hearings, and that's how it proceeded.
He was kind of in and out of custody as I read the record.
I think that's correct. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
If the court has no further questions, I would simply ask this court to affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Ms. Lockwood, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to start by addressing opposing counsel's comment that this case is just like State v. Lamar. Again, in State
counsel,
v. Lamar,
I know how it's different than State v. Lamar, and you have very little time left. So one thing I'd like you to discuss is you've cited as pertinent authority the unpublished case of Walford,
yes.
And I'm wondering why, in your view, Walford supports what you're asking us to do.
Walford is essentially the exact same scenario we have here. In Walford, in an order opinion, this court remanded for the hearing I'm asking for in this situation. In Walford, the appellant requested to discharge the public defender's office and go pro se, argued that there was a breakdown in the relationship, didn't give any other basis. The court said that they would not be able to appoint him another public defender, similar misadvice here.
So you're saying it's the same, you're citing it for support because this decision that we're looking at in Walford is a post-remand decision.
Is exactly what I'm asking for here, is what they did in Walford. The court in Walford found that the district—
Understood. So let me just ask you this.
Yes.
In Walford, we quoted Gillen saying, exceptional circumstances are those that affect court-appointed attorney's ability or competence to represent the client. General dissatisfaction with appointed counsel does not amount to an exceptional circumstance, nor does personal tension in the attorney-client relationship. And I think in that case, the defendant had alleged that the attorney wasn't prepared to represent him at trial 13 months in. So what I'm wondering here is how the circumstances here show exceptional circumstances, show that counsel wasn't able or competent or wasn't prepared at trial, had any more than a general dissatisfaction with how his attorney was conducting the case, and frustration that his attorney wasn't meeting with him more or doing more with him.
How is that different than this case?
Yes.
It's not different than this case. It's very similar to this case. It's the same concerns that were voiced by Mr. Garza here, that his attorney wasn't
Then in
communicating with him.
Walford, we said the record does not reflect that appellant, the record does reflect that appellant was generally dissatisfied with his public defender and that there was personal tension between them. The district court so found. The district court concluded, however, that this dissatisfaction and tension did not affect appellant's public defender's ability or competence to represent appellant at trial. And we said, that's it. So I'm looking at this case, looking for what in the record would allow us to conclude that trial counsel was not able or competent to represent appellant at trial. And I'm also wondering if your response is, we don't know because the record's inadequate, why you did not stay this appeal, move for post-conviction relief, have an evidentiary hearing at which you could have developed the necessary factual record that would enable us to have a broader review of the issue.
Because
Why instead you're coming on direct appeal and saying remand? Well, you don't just get a remand. You have a post-conviction remedy available to you at which you could develop the record.
this is exactly what the court did in Walford. They brought the issue up on direct appeal, and this court in Walford said, we don't know if he had exceptional circumstances. That is not proven. They acknowledged he didn't prove exceptional circumstances. And this Walford opinion is after that remanded hearing was conducted. So that's why that's exactly what we're asking for. We don't have the findings in Walford because we haven't had a remand. This took place after the case was remanded for that exact hearing for the district court to determine whether there were exceptional circumstances that affected his attorney's ability or competence to
Well,
represent
I'm looking
him.
at the opinion. It says we remanded the case to district court with directions to conduct an inquiry into appellant's statement that there was an irreparable breakdown in the attorney-client relationship. Where in the record here did your client ever say there's been an irreparable breakdown in the attorney-client relationship?
They're only using that phrase, not that it's a legal term of art for the purposes of this analysis, but because that's what the defendant said. They don't know what he meant by that. That's just the phrase he used. So in my case, the allegation is lack of communication and failure to show him any of his discovery.
Here's the thing. I was a public defender for 13 years. I'm a broken record on this. You know, in that position, there are many times where you are not able to do your first meeting with your client as soon as you would like to because he's incarcerated someplace and you have 50 other clients to defend that week. You don't have the discovery yet. You don't. So, I mean, just to say, well, my client hasn't met with me yet and he hasn't shown me discovery yet, that's not the equivalent of saying there's an irreparable breakdown in the attorney-client relationship. It's impossible for us to communicate. My client refuses to talk to me. I go to visit my client, he won't talk to me. There's case law talking about the irreparable breakdown in the attorney-client relationship in the context of court-appointed counsel. So this isn't just like, oh, this is just some random phrase they chose. We were recognizing that that's a sort of serious circumstance which may prevent effective representation. I'm not seeing anything like that alleged here. I'm just seeing not happy that we haven't had as much communication. I'm not happy that I didn't get my discovery soon enough. Are you alleging that he never received discovery?
We don't know.
But
There's no
he never
record that
again
he did.
complained about lack of discovery.
He did. And I see my time has run. May I briefly respond?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. So the irreconcilable differences, or however it phrased it again, is just the term that the defendant used in that case. It's also not the standard required in Minnesota. The standard for the federal courts is an irreparable or irreconcilable conflict or complete breakdown. But Minnesota requires exceptional circumstances that affect a court-appointed attorney's ability or competence to represent the client. And we know through our case law that if someone is not communicating effectively and has not shown their discovery in a timely manner to their client, that qualifies as under the standard.
What
Now,
case law says that?
it's cited too in my principal brief.
There's published authority saying that failure to meet with the client,
No,
not
failure to
ever, but
communicate. Failure to communicate with the client.
is there an allegation of no communication, or we just didn't have visits as soon as we would like?
There was an allegation of no communication here. Absolutely none. At the May 2nd hearing, he said, "This is the first time I've gotten a hold of my attorney." He didn't get in
But
contact
your
with me.
client was in custody in Renville County in that first hearing, appeared via Zoom.
And counsel,
He
just
had numerous hearings before
realistically,
then.
I'd say I'll go out on a limb here saying there are very few times when a defendant who's appointed counsel has had the opportunity to meet with counsel before the first appearance.
This is
Was
several appearances in. We're not at the first appearance at this point. It's an omnibus hearing. He has had four court appearances before this. This is his fifth court appearance. And again, all we're asking for is the exact relief that was given in Walford by this court is a remedy so that the court can determine whether there were exceptional circumstances.
And if there were, then we need to go on and consider whether or not he was harmed as a result of the failure to have a different attorney appointed.
The district court can conduct that analysis. That's actually in the order opinion what this court directed them to do was, and you can read that in the unpublished Walford as well, is that if there was harm, the court would go on to determine whether a new trial was warranted. And if there was no harm, like they found, then the conviction stands. I see there are no further questions, and my time has absolutely run. So I ask that you reverse and remand for reconsideration of his request for substitute counsel. Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. This is the final oral argument on today's oral calendar, so the court is now in recess.